the Senate Transportation Committee to order and let the record show that it is April 26th and 1:10 p.m. Today, what we will be doing for the majority of the bills that we will be hearing, and I believe there's 10 on the calendar here, the majority of them will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill, with the exception of three, the last three bills that will be re-referred to committees that want to see them. We will be hearing the we will be putting together the omnibus policy bill on Thursday, so just so the members are aware of that, and we'll be bringing all of that together at that time. This first bill, Senator Weaker, and welcome to the committee. I just want to say that this provision is already in the House Finance bill, which is in conference committee at this time, but we'll hear the bill and then also lay it over for possible inclusion in our policy bill. So, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much. Senate File 1042, also known as Tyler's Law, addresses the need for increased awareness on the danger of carbon monoxide poisoning. Thousands of persons go to emergency room across our country. Hundreds die each year, including 15 to 20 Minnesotans. You're going to hear a sad story about Tyler in December of this year. And while there is generally an awareness that carbon monoxide is an odorless, colorless, and lethal gas, many people don't realize that even if your garage door is open in Minnesota winters, it's not going to escape that gas. And part of the information that we found, police officers and others have said, that there needs to be more information in driver's training, in the manual, in the instruction. So Senate File 1042 would deliver on that need. And I have handouts for you that give some further background about the issue. But members and Mr. Chair, I'd like you to hear firsthand why we're here. And I have here the Laver family. Jeff is going to introduce his spouse and his kids, and we'll proceed.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Weaker. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Jeff Lavers, and with me is my wife, Kelly, our son, Shane, and our daughter, Nicolette. And thank you, Senator Weaker, for allowing us to be here. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, on behalf of my wife and family and many friends who are with us today, we thank you for allowing me this brief time to discuss with you and this committee something so dangerous and yet so preventable, carbon monoxide poisoning. We strongly ask for your support of Senate File 1042 or Tyler's Law, specifically requesting the critical information be added to the current Minnesota driver's education training, as well as the corresponding questions in the Minnesota driver's license test related to the understanding of the dangers of carbon monoxide poisoning. To appreciate the devastation this silent, deadly killer inflicts, please allow me briefly to tell you of my family's story. This past summer, our oldest son, Tyler, a sophomore at the University of Minnesota, worked a part-time job to earn money to buy a car. Tyler did his homework and was very pleased with his purchase, a 1998 Pontiac Grand Prix. A few months later, he decided to install a stereo in his car. He did thorough research prior to making his purchase, buying a system that he was convinced would be the envy of his friends and most certainly the grief of his parents, knowing that we would be able to hear that stereo two blocks from our house. Tyler did all the installation himself, again, working hard to learn and understand the intricacies of stereo wiring, electrical systems, and even built his own subwoofer. Tyler also learned that the power needed to run his stereo required a new alternator, which he, again, taught himself how to install. We are very proud of our 19-year-old son, his work ethic, and his desire to learn. Yet this smart, motivated, and energized young man was lacking in basic knowledge of key facts that very likely cost him his life. On the evening of December 1st, 2010, Tyler finished his studies and wanted to work on the final touches of his speakers. Reluctantly, my wife, Kelly, allowed him to travel out to our cabin, not far from our house where most of our tools were located. Once there, Tyler backed his car into the garage, as the best lighting is towards the rear of the garage, as are the tools. Sometime past midnight, Tyler must have needed to test the speakers, and knowing the battery would drain if he turned on the car without running the car, he started it. What we later learned is that in as few as 5 minutes, Tyler was likely unconscious and quite possibly dead in 15 minutes. Thinking he was into his work as he usually was, my wife Kelly wanted to check on his efforts to make sure he did not stay too late. She called him, and when he did not answer his phone, she began to worry, and she drove out to the cabin and found him lying unconscious in the back of his car under his speakers. Unfortunately, at that moment, I was out of town on a business trip and was woken by her frantic call, telling me that Tyler was not responding and to come home immediately. I will never forget not being there, not being able to relieve my wife of her devastating discovery, and always wishing I could have done something that may have kept my son alive. I learned of the unsuccessful effort of an amazing group of first responders to revive Tyler, and I first heard of his ultimate death while in the back seat of a taxi early on December 2nd, racing to the airport to try to get a flight home. Only now am I coming to grips with the fact that the only thing that could have kept him alive was knowledge. Knowledge that we are quite sure very few of us are aware. In the weeks following Tyler's death, we have come in contact with too many people who have lost loved ones from a similar fate at the hands of this unforgiving assassin. What has stayed with us most is that had Tyler been aware of key facts of carbon monoxide and carbon monoxide poisoning, he would likely be alive today. The recorded data states that at least 15 to 20 Minnesotans die from carbon monoxide poisoning each year. That number is likely higher, as it is not a requirement to list the cause of death, simply when we can put an accident on the death report. Had Tyler and others known what experts know, that at no time in Minnesota should you idle your car in your garage, even with the door open, that cold weather magnifies the concentration of CO gas as well as confines it, and that the poison that is carbon monoxide can seamlessly penetrate into a house or apartment from an attached garage easily and silently, killing all inside. We have learned from the Center of Disease Control, emergency room attendants, medical examiners, first responders and paramedics, fire and police officers, many of whom have written to you supporting the fact that education is the key. Tyler believed in a simple yet powerful concept of empowerment. He understood the responsibilities that come from his actions. Tyler lived this every day. With education comes empowerment. We respectfully ask for your support for this bill, Senate File 1042, or Tyler's Law. It is a simple, inexpensive ask with a small one-time expense. It is vital to include in driver's education training and, more importantly, in the driver's license test of the dangers of carbon monoxide poisoning and what you can do to keep yourself safe, and in our case, keep yourself alive. 52,000 tests are taken each year in the state of Minnesota. Surely critical direct education of this danger will keep someone alive. Certainly education will help prevent not only another accidental death, but a tragedy that forever scars the lives of those involved, as Tyler's death has done to our family. Mr. Chairman and committee members, we thank you for your time and for your support. Thank you.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members and the Lavers family, thank you very much for being here, sharing your story of strength and courage, taking an experience that's been tragic and difficult and turning it into an opportunity to help other families. So I just want to thank you. I also want to thank Senator Wieger for chiefing this bill and Representative Kiefer for doing the same in the House. This is an inexpensive opportunity to educate students about carbon monoxide poisoning, the effects of it, and one of the cases with carbon monoxide, I think we've all worked in garages. We've all done this. And in this case, this young gentleman has paid that sacrifice, paid with his life. and by educating people about what the effects of carbon monoxide poisoning are, we do have the opportunity to reduce or eliminate this in the future. So I encourage all of us to please support this bill.
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, did you indicate that you are going to hold this bill for the omnibus policy bill or not?
Yes, Senator Rust, that was that's what we are going to do with it. It's also already in the finance bill on the House side, so we'll
so
be
Mr.
conferring
Chairman, does
that,
that mean that your
Senator
policy
Rust.
Bill, would it otherwise have to go to the Finance Committee?
With the fiscal note that's attached to it, it may have to go there, right? We're going to confer with Senator
Robling.
The other reason
why the policy bill would have to go to the, is there a fiscal note on the on other provisions in the policy bill that would prevent this bill from moving separately? That's all I'm asking.
It, there are other provisions in the
they
policy bill.
Impact.
Yes, there,
okay.
But
thank you very
yeah,
much.
We have decided that we wanted to discuss this with Senator Roebling before we brought it over to finance for her. But as long as it was included in the in our finance bill, that we felt that this is a, just an, another path for this bill to take. So
thank
you for your
Chairman.
Comments, Senator Rust.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to reiterate my gratitude for your granting us a hearing on behalf of the Lavers family, also on behalf of their many friends and neighbors that are here in the audience as well. And also to each of you, we have bipartisan authorship, but you have had a number of email contacts and others, and I respect the courteous, thoughtful responses that so many of you have shared to their family. That means a lot.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, and to the Lavers family, thank you for your presentation, and I believe I can speak on behalf of the committee here. We offer our condolences for your loss, and if there is anything that may mediate that a little bit is that potentially with this bill, others won't lose their life over this, and so it won't be all a loss. So, again, we're sorry for your loss, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that will hold that the bill over for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Next up is Senate File 532, Senator Vandeveer. Welcome to the committee, Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did somebody move the bill?
Senator Howell? Nope, Senator Howell is not here. Senator Gazilka moves Senate File 532.
Thank you.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank
policy
you, Mr.
Chairman.
Members, Senate File 532 allows collector emergency vehicles to display and use non-conforming colored lights. Because they're old, they don't have the modern arrangement on the vehicles. And here to explain the need for the bill is Mr. Straczynski. And we do have a couple of amendments, so if you'd like, if we could get have those moved on. I think they're mostly mainly technical.
Do you have a particular order you want to take those amendments, Senator Vandeveer?
We could take the A2 amendment first, I think.
We'll get that passed out here as quickly as we can. To the amendment, though, if you would like to explain it as we're passing it out.
Sure. Mr. Straczynski can probably explain the difference between the amendment and the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The amendment deals with adding a section which says that you may not activate the emergency lights on these antique emergency vehicles while you're driving down the street. They may only be activated when they're in a parade or when they're on a display someplace in a collector show or collector car show or something like that. This is an amendment was added at the suggestion of the Minnesota Highway Patrol, and we're okay with that. And the other part, I mean, that's what that amendment does, Mr. Chairman. The A2 amendment.
Senator Rust?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's an author's amendment, so maybe we should vote on it first, but then I had a question about it.
Okay. Senator DeKreif moves the A2 amendment to Senate File 532. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion Mr. prevails. Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, with this amendment, does the State Patrol and or the Department of Public Safety support your bill? Are they neutral, or what is their position with regard to your bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, good question. I haven't asked them about supporting the bill. They wanted this amendment on it. We put it on there. They're very happy that the amendment's gone on the bill. That was important to them. I do know that they did tell me that they've got three vehicles themselves which are nonconforming, and so they're pleased to have this thing fixed. But there's no official position that I know from the commissioner's office.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest?
At some point, once all the amendments are on, I'd like to have some sort of statement from the State Patrol or DPS, their opinion about what we're doing here.
Certainly, Senator Rest. We'll ask them to come up.
Thank you.
Would you like to offer your second amendment, or did you have one?
Mr. Chair, could I just...
Senator Sengel.
Sorry. Chair, I'm not so sure there's not smaller town fire departments out there, and I don't know what an authorized light is. I just know that there's smaller towns that have a lot of old fire trucks, and they still work, and they might have a little bubble light on top. And matter of fact, it seems like I just saw one to the last week. And I'm just wondering whether or not this would preclude those trucks, at least with existing lighting, from functioning anymore.
Ms. Berezovsky?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sengem, on the A2 amendment on 1.8, there is a restriction that the vehicle has to be operated solely as a collector's item and not for general purposes in order to be able to display the nonconforming lights. So this authorization is just for collector vehicles.
And Ms. Chair,
Senator Sengem.
I'm not sure. I don't know what an authorized light is. But I do know there's a lot of older functional vehicles out there in our smaller communities that still, you know, work in the fire service. And I'm just suggesting it's a possible problem.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's why we need to hear from those folks.
I believe Major Urquhart is here. We'll have him come forward and... Well, maybe he can answer your question, Senator Sengel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Major Ken Urquhart with the Minnesota State Patrol. To your question, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator, is that those fire trucks that are in service by a political subdivision, they would be considered emergency vehicles, and they would be certainly allowed to utilize that equipment when they're responding to a fire call or some other kind of incident of emergency.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I guess that clarifies it.
Any other questions? Senator Rust?
Well, Mr.
Just
Chairman, then, does the State Patrol, then are they neutral on the bill then, or do they have a position?
Major Urquhart?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust, our concern here was that the way the bill was originally drafted, that it did not preclude someone from operating one of these collector vehicles indiscriminately down the highway utilizing those red lights. As you well know, just most recently, a number of our troopers have become targets on the highway, and we certainly don't want to see more vehicles utilizing these kinds of lights unless they absolutely need to.
So, Mr. Chairman and sir, so the A2 amendment takes care of any concern you had. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, it does.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sengel.
Just to maybe go back to my thought, I mean, obviously we heard the testimony, and that's the testimony. But what I guess I'm wondering is if the testimony is reflected somewhere in statute. It kind of seems to me if you just read this, you know, the small town fire department with a fire truck with a little gumball on top may feel they're obsolete and need to put a new so-called color bar or rack on top that brings it up to date. I'm just wondering about unintended consequences. If what was testified to is somewhere else in statute, then it's no problem. But
Mr. Straczynski?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, Fire Departments Association, and we were behind this bill, as well as I represent the Minnesota Street Rod Association, which supports this bill as well. In order to qualify, in fact, the emergency lights on vehicles has evolved over a number of years, and the current status of those emergency lights, different color configurations existed before, blue lights versus red lights, amber lights, and what have you. Many of the vehicles do not meet the current statutory definition of what emergency lights should be on an emergency vehicle. So we tried to be practical about this and simply say if the vehicle has a collector plate or if it's got a classic pioneer plate, or a street rod plate or something like that on the vehicle, and it's a collector vehicle, and it's not being used for general transportation, that means driven on the highway on a daily basis, then the vehicle is authorized to be legal with lights that are no longer conforming to current statutes and rules. That's the purpose of this. Here's a couple of examples of two vehicles that are collector vehicles owned by fire departments that are technically illegal under today's law, driving them to and from an event. So this law just basically says it's okay to drive those vehicles to and from an event. And I think all the local fire departments are in compliance. They don't, first of all, they don't have one of those kinds of plates on their vehicle, but we're pretty confident after having a year's worth of discussion amongst the Fire Departments Association that they're all conforming with their regular vehicles.
Senator Vanderveers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Senjum, if I'm understanding your question, are you concerned that we are expanding a restriction somehow inadvertently here?
Senator Senjum?
Mr. Chair and Senator Vanderveer, no, I'm just concerned about, and I wish I could remember, it just seems to me that within the last week in someplace in southern Minnesota, I came upon a small-town fire department going to a fire, and it had and I don't know if this is authorized or not, a little gumball light on top, and whether or not now this amendment would make them, if you will, illegal. That's my only concern.
Major Eckhart?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, to my understanding, if the vehicle qualifies as an emergency vehicle or it's an approved emergency vehicle approved by the Commissioner of Public Safety, that it would be allowed to be operated in that fashion. So if it's being utilized by a fire department, it would be considered an emergency vehicle. The way I read this legislation is that this legislation strictly deals with vehicles that are registered under those subdivisions under 168.10, which are those categories, if I remember right, collector, pioneer plates, okay. Those types of categories. So we're not talking about in-use emergency vehicles.
Okay. I'm done.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Senator Rest.
Not to berate this, but I just want to clarify from my own understanding that the A2 amendment is essentially a delete everything amendment because it takes out all the language there and just adds another section, takes out all the new language, and now this language is replacing it in the A2 amendment. Is that correct, Senator Vanderveer?
That is my
Senator
understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Vanderveer, did you have another amendment?
I did, Mr. Chair, if we could have the A1 amendment.
Okay. Pass out the A1 amendment.
This is a technical amendment, I think.
Pardon me?
This would be a technical amendment. Mr. Straczynski could. That's what that's for.
Mr. Chairman, I think the amendment needs to be corrected, if I may, on page. On the A2 amendment, instead of amending, you have to amend line 1.8. After the amendment's drafted to the original Senate file, not to the delete amendment, but if you amend after line 1.8, after the word general, you need to add the word transportation. So instead of line 13, it should be line 1, page 1, line 8, after the word general, add the word transportation. And the reason for that is...
And it has to be drawn to the A2 amendment.
Correct.
A2 amendment, correct. Does everybody understand the amendment to the amendment? Senator Gazelka moves the... what should probably now be a verbal or oral amendment to the A2 amendment, inserting transportation after general on line 1.8. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chairman, that's the definition basically used by the patrol and the Department of Public Safety. General transportation is a plate we all have on our vehicles. We drive every day on the street. These vehicles are not licensed or titled that way.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Senator Vanderveer. We will lay this bill over for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you.
Senator Howe is in a committee. Senator Wolf just walked out. Senator DeKreif, are you ready with Senate File 785?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Pratt.
What Senate File 785 essentially does is it's an attempt to simplify Minnesota's permitting process. What I do for a living is I do overweight permitting in the lower 48 states. And Minnesota has a provision that I don't find really in other states. Typically, when you get an oversized permit to move a large piece of equipment, sometimes you're grossing 500,000 pounds, sometimes 750,000 pounds. I've even obtained permits for over 1 million pounds around the nation. And once you get that oversized permit, you're ready to go. You can then move that load. But in Minnesota, there's an extra step that always needed to be taken place, and that was to raise the weight, your registered weight of your vehicle. Most semi-tractors are registered at 80,000 pounds. And, in the case of, some loads, you'd have to raise your registered weight up to 750,000 pounds for a period of time. They have simplified it some. It used to be you would have to go back in and actually ask for a refund for the balance of the year. But now they give you a 30-day permit, basically, at that higher weight. What this bill attempts to do is not to put a fiscal note on it, although today I see that there's a fiscal note that's being tied with it that I was unprepared for. What I basically was asking for is I was asking to have this the extra weight be added on to the price of the permit, for the amount of days of the permit. So if you get a 7-day permit, you would essentially pay the added weight prorated for the 7 days. And to my way of thinking, there shouldn't be a fiscal note tied with that. So I guess what I would do, Mr. Chair, is I would ask that we move this onto the omnibus bill, which might give us a little bit of time to get rid of this fiscal note, because I would really like to do that.
Certainly, we have planned to hold it over for possible inclusion, but... it looks like from the fiscal note that it really doesn't have a fiscal. Oh, there's a second page. Okay. Is there somebody from MnDOT here that can comment on this fiscal note? Why don't we cover it that way, Senator?
Okay.
DeKreif, get some input on that.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Gene Halverson, and I work in the Commercial Vehicle Operations section of MnDOT. The reason for the fiscal note is, based on our understanding of what the senator was trying to do here, is that our computers would have to talk to the Department of Public Safety computers, their mainframe, our computers, our route builder computer, which is our routing and permitting computer. And then it has to go into U.S. Bank where the fees are collected, so there'd have to be another connection there. I'm not a computer person, so when this bill came up and we got to looking at it, it was sent down to the computer folks within the department, and that's where the number came back from, that it's extremely costly to do this kind of computer work. So that's what the fiscal note is about. However, in talking to the senator before the meeting, it appears that there's probably a simpler way of doing this that would get rid of the majority of that fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Halverson. And like we said, we'll hold this over for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill, and that'll give you some time to work out this fiscal note and the details of that. But certainly it would cause us some concern, if it, especially seeing the size of the numbers in this note. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are we going to see a revised fiscal note for this bill before the omnibus transportation policy bill comes before us? I'm not asking you, Senator Kreif. It's not your responsibility. It's a department.
Mr. Halverson? Mr.
Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, I believe so. If we can work out some language here, then the fiscal note would change.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
And so what would be a simpler process that would reduce the fiscal impact?
The idea that I presented, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, the idea presented to Ms. McCormick from Public Safety and then to the senator would be that when a person calls in to get an overweight permit, that we do one transaction at that time instead of them having to go through DPS or deputy registers to increase their registration. You would pay for the permit, and a surcharge, a percentage surcharge, would be attached right to the permit for the weight that you're going to carry, for the number of months that you're going to carry it. And that way there would be, you'd only be dealing with one agency, one transaction, and I think it would be simplified for us as far as the fiscal part of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Senator DeKreif, is what he is proposing, does that solve the problem that you're trying to address in your bill to, as what I understand it, to more streamline this process to start with? Does that answer it, or does it make it worse?
Senator DeKreif.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I want to look at that a little closer. I think it would be a step in the right direction. Right now, what I really want to do is I want to make Minnesota more business friendly and make it easier to work through this process, which can be very complex as it is. So my intent is to simplify this and make it a one-stop shop. And my intent was not to short the state any money. It was to end up with a zero fiscal note on this, and that's why this was something of a surprise today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Ms. McCormick, is there something you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. Just to explain, our fiscal note really just shows a decrease in revenue, and that's because we would no longer be having the $3 fee that is charged for the change in the registration and the weight, and then the filing fee for the deputy registrars. They would no longer get the $8.50 filing fee that they would get for processing the weight change for the registration. So ours is not an additional cost. It's just less revenue that would be coming in that our fiscal note shows as. So I just wanted to explain that. but it shows it as a result. It means that we don't have that revenue coming into the state anymore. So that's what our fiscal note is showing.
Just a point of clarification, Ms. McCormick, do they get the $8.50 every time they change the weight of the vehicle? So if they raise it, they get $8.50. If they then when they come back and reduce it, do they get the additional or just a fee for doing that?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. This would the DVS is certainly supportive of streamlining the process, and as you know, right now our computer system wouldn't be able to electronically communicate with another computer system, but MnDOT has some ideas in terms of how this could occur, and so we're certainly open to looking at those ideas. We just haven't had time to discuss it.
Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but the bulk of the fiscal note is coming from MnDOT, not from DPS. I think we need to make that clear. I mean, the DPS one is fairly minimal. It's the $750,000 hit on MnDOT that needs to be addressed here,
right.
Much more so than 17 of reduced revenues to DPS or the deputy registrars.
And that's correct. We'll Ms. McCormick?
No, Mr. Chair, yes, I would agree with Senator Rest. We just, obviously, we always have to document any change that it would be in our current, revenue. But certainly we are, Mr. Halverson and I did talk to Senator DeCreef and talked about trying to work to see if there was a way we could accommodate it. But we need some time.
Senator DeCreef.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, when fiscal notes always never, or I should say never cease to amaze me, because if there's extra work that's taken on by an agency, they immediately put a fiscal note on that it's going to take more personnel. But in this case, there's probably less transactions that would have to take place, so there would be less work needed to be done by the agency, and yet there's still a fiscal note on. I understand that there's maybe a fee that wouldn't be charged, but to me, it should be a wash at very least, just because of the fact that there's less work that would have to be done and less transactions that would have to be done. So I'm trying to bring some common sense into this and simplification into this process and make it more business friendly.
Thank you, Senator DeCraft. Mr. Halverson?
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator DeCraft, the lack of work would not be on our part. We would still do the same amount of work because we would have to issue the permit. Where the reduced workload would be over on the DPS side, and no, I can't do anything about that.
Certainly. Any other questions from the committee? Well, thank you, Senator DeCraft. We will hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you. Would you like me to stay up here for the next?
Yes.
Okay.
That is Senate File 1121.
Mr. Chair, I've been asked. I'm sorry,
Senator DeCreef. Okay. Just recognizing you, sir.
All right, I've been asked to bring Senate File 1121 forward by MnDOT to streamline, I believe, and expedite some changes to their bill. And I'll let Eric
Rudine, Mr.
Rudine, explain that.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. Section 1 of the bill simply allows driving a vehicle to display a permit electronically rather than having to print a paper copy of the permit. Section 2 of the bill is a new annual permit for trucks between 145,000 and 155,000 pounds. Today, these trucks have to buy a single trip permit, and there was a request from Associated General Contractors to provide the option of an annual permit. So this does not require them to purchase an annual permit, but if they so desire, they can get an annual permit instead of a single trip permit. And then Section 3 of the bill deals with people who have had their driver's license suspended or revoked. The legislature in 2009 made some changes so that if you had your license suspended or revoked for a non-driving related offense, you would still be able to apply for a medical waiver for a commercial driver's license. And that's the way we had been enforcing the law, but there was a case that went to an administrative law judge, and we realized that the law in 2009 was not drafted correctly. So this simply restores what the legislature intended to do in 2009, so that if you've had your license suspended or revoked for a non-driving related offense, you can still apply for that medical waiver. But if it was a driving related offense, you have to wait 3 years before you're eligible for a medical waiver.
Any questions? Thank you, Senator DeCryfe, and we will again pull this over for the policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Saxog, you are ready. We will take your bill next, Senate File 1148.
Appreciate that, Chairman Gimsey and members. Today, as you say, I have Senate File 1148. This bill will make some changes to existing law relating to rail bank property. And with me today, again, is Eric Radin from MnDOT, and he's going to give some brief testimony on the need for this change and help answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have a couple of handouts. One of them is a map showing the current rail bank property in the state of Minnesota. These are former rail lines that have been abandoned by a railroad, and so the state has gone in to purchase these corridors to preserve them for future transportation or utility purposes, and they have today trails running on them. The Blue Ox Trail, which goes from International Falls to Bemidji, the Central Lakes Trail, and Lake Wobegon Trail, which go west from the St. Cloud area. You should also have a couple of pictures about some of the problems we've been having on rail bank property. And so what the bill does is it just sort of clarifies about the types of activities that would be prohibited on state rail bank property, and it also increases the penalty from a petty misdemeanor to a misdemeanor. Currently, a petty misdemeanor is a $300 fine, and a misdemeanor is a $1,000 fine. And the reason we're asking that to be strengthened is that we've had some violators who have told us to go ahead and issue them the ticket for petty misdemeanor. They would rather just pay the $300 fine and continue violating the uses of the rail bank property. So that's why we're asking for that penalty to be strengthened.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Senate File 1148 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judicial and Public Safety.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxog, is this, the state owns this property currently? Is that what we're doing here? We're just making it tougher for violators?
Mr. Rudin.
Go ahead, Mr. D.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct. This is property that used to have rail lines on it. The railroads abandoned the rail lines, and so the legislature many years ago directed the Department of Transportation to purchase those corridors to preserve them. And today they do have trails running on them. But this is state-owned property, and MnDOT is responsible for maintaining this property.
Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. Mr. Radin, so this is state property. I see it looks like a deer stand there. Can you deer hunt on this property now?
Mr. Radin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, that is not one of the activities that is expressly prohibited, but the deer stand is something that's, you know, a semi-permanent structure, and we've had people also erect storage sheds, for example, on our state rail bank property. So we're not necessarily looking to outlaw hunting activities, but it's really the placement of these structures on the rail bank property that we're looking to prohibit.
And Senator Gazelka, that obviously is not a deer hunting stand. You can look at the base of it, and no deer hunter would ever leave that type of garbage in the stand. Incredible deer hunter.
Mr. Chair, those are two pictures, but I'm thinking the older I get, that stand looks pretty nice.
Compared to some I've been in, it looks pretty nice too, Senator. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to follow up on that. It appears that whoever was up there liked Bud Light and Mountain Dew together by the pictures.
It's unfortunate in any case. No wonder.
I wouldn't know, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall moves Senate file 1142 be recommended to pass, 48, excuse me, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I was asked by MnDOT to bring forward this bill, that miscellaneous transportation bill, and I'll let Mr. Eric Radin explain the bill to you.
Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is MnDOT's housekeeping bill. Section 1 establishes the Mississippi River Bike Trail in statute. This trail has actually been established in partnership with local governments already. It parallels the Mississippi River. It's part of a 10-state effort that goes all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. You should have a map in your packet that lists some of the communities the bike trail goes through. Portions of it are on state highways. Portions of it are also on local roadways. So, again, as I said, the trail has been established. We held a series of meetings throughout the state to come up with the route of the trail, and this just formalizes it in statute. Section 2 of the bill just makes a correction to legislation that was enacted last year designating a Veterans Memorial Highway in up in northwestern Minnesota. There was just an error in the way the bill was drafted, so it just fixes a couple of references. Section 3 of the bill deals with a flashing yellow arrow, and you have a handout describing a little bit more detail the concept here, but this would be a permissive turn on a flashing yellow arrow where you would have to yield to oncoming traffic. It's the same concept today you see at many intersections where you have a solid green light, but you have to yield to the oncoming traffic. There have been studies that show that the flashing yellow arrow is safer than the steady green because people, when they see green, they think it's safe to go, but actually this is a turn where you have to yield to oncoming traffic. So it's our hope that these flashing yellow arrows will be a little bit safer. We would just install these as we're installing new signal systems or replacing existing signal systems. This would not be something we go out and do everywhere overnight. But as I said, we would replace these as they come up for replacement.
Mr. Radin, this would replace that sign that is above some of the streetlights that say left turn on green permissible. blah, blah, blah.
Right. Correct, Mr. Chair. This would be in replace of that. So that's sections 3 and 4 of the bill. The remainder of the bill, sections 5 through 8, deal with the Federal Rail Service Continuation Program. This is a program that has been repealed, and so rather than refer to that specific program, we would just refer to funds available from the federal government. This is for the freight rail program, Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, that you may have heard about. These are small, short line, and regional railroads that are eligible for state assistance.
Any questions on the bill? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Howell, and we will hold it over for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Wolf. Senator Wolf, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Senate File 1124.
Okay. Senator Wolf moves Senate File 1124 on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would actually like to turn it over to Cherie Marty, who is the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety, to explain the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Marty. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Cherie Marty, the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with DPS. Essentially, Senate File 1124, what it does is it clarifies existing statute language that would put Minnesota back into compliance for child passenger safety or booster seat funding, which is approximately $378,000 per year. So this is really essentially a technical change to get us back into compliance to receive those funds.
Hey, Ms. Marty, can you tell us how much those federal funds are and
yes,
where
Mr.
they are currently being
Yeah,
appropriated?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I just wanted to mention these are federal funds through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And we receive, and the level of funding can change each year, but the last time that we received this money in 2009, it was for an amount of $378,000. So we anticipate having that money again this coming year if we can get us back into federal and meeting those federal requirements to receive this money. Essentially, when we passed the 2010 school bus exemption, that the federal government saw that exemption being too broad for their liking. And so their interpretation, they felt that it included some vehicles that should not be exempted from the booster seat requirement.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
thanks, Mr. Chair. Have we already forfeited dollars by being out of compliance, or if we have, do we have the opportunity to recoup?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, yes, we have. We missed out of funding in 2010 because we were out of compliance. So this will put us back into compliance for 2011 and 12 and for future years.
Senator Dibble, follow
Thanks,
up?
Mr. Chair. We have the opportunity to regain those dollars that we lost, or are they just gone forever?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, those dollars are lost.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Marty, help me understand this a little bit. I'm trying to read this. So what this does,
As I see this, it includes. Wait, I'm trying to understand what it excludes and what it who ends up having the restraints and who doesn't. I'm trying to figure this one out as I'm reading this here. Could you help me with that,
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and senators of the committee, essentially what this the clarification does is that it is requiring that while operating a school bus, that they are exempted. And these are buses that have a gross vehicle weighting of over 10,000 pounds. So if you're not a school bus at that particular weight threshold, then you are required to use the booster seat. You are not exempted. So it was the Type 3 vehicles that were in the federal's interpretation that they were included in the exemption, and they were concerned about that, and that's why they're asking for us to make this language clarification. So Type 3 vehicles are cars, station wagons, 10-passenger vans, those types of vehicles that are typically less than 10,000 pounds, that weight limit. So they would be required to use the booster seat.
Senator Baer?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, then, Ms. Marty, what kind of expense will this shift on to, you know, any schools, any bus services that are under that $10,000 limit? And they're going to have to go out and buy these child seats to be able to handle any of these passengers?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Senator, what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask Lieutenant Ed Carroll with the Minnesota State Patrol with our pupil transportation group if he could answer your question, if that would be allowed.
Absolutely. Answer the question.
Mr. Chairman.
Carroll, welcome to the committee.
Lieutenant Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. I'm the State Director of Pupil Transportation Safety.
Lieutenant Carroll, would you like to have Senator Perry resubmit his question?
Mr. Chair, I will. Lieutenant Carroll, I guess what I'm concerned about is on the vehicles now that are under 10,000 pounds, these companies, these schools are going to have to go out now and buy booster seats to equip their vehicles to use them then in moving people?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, most of them already have purchased the child seats because of the change in 2010 when we did do the change. We brought them out of with the exemption, and what happened is influenced a very small amount of buses. There's approximately 14,671 buses in Minnesota. Okay, the smaller buses, there's probably 1,615 of those that we inspected last year. Those are the Type A's. Those are the small buses. Of those, we did a straw poll with the Minnesota Association of Pupil Transporters and MSBOA, which is the contractors, and they said this is going to probably affect somewhere around 100 to 150 of their buses. That's a straw poll. They sent out a survey. They want to know how this law would affect them, and that's about the amount of buses that it's amount of buses that it is really going to affect.
Is there somebody here from the School Board Association or somebody from that association that would like to testify on this? Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I believe this would be a mandate on the public schools, and though we had it at one time, we worked with the State Patrol last year to change this law, that we're back again changing for the third year in a row. And at some point, this gets so muddled in bus specifics that it's virtually impossible to pass an inspection. And we'd really appreciate some consistency in the law and in this area. And it would be an additional cost to us. Even 150 buses, that would cost significant local dollars that we don't get our aid appropriated for.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I guess, Lieutenant Carroll, I want to go back. Not that I don't want kids to be safe. You know, I want to set that up front. But it concerns me that we would split a fleet, irregardless of the size. And so I'm wondering why, if why we would just single out those under 10,000 pounds.
Okay.
Senator Carroll?
Mr. Chair. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, where we came in conflict with them is any vehicle under 10,000 pounds. Any vehicle under 10,000 pounds is equipped with a seatbelt, mandatory in all occupant positions, excluding a motorcycle. Okay. The reason why they say that is because the frames are so light on them, and that's why they require a seatbelt. After 2011, they'll require both lap and shoulder restraints after 2011. They can't be built without them. And the reason why we're sideways with this law is they figure the lighter frames, they can't take the collision as a less stable platform. That comes from National Highway Traffic Administration. I called them directly. We docket right here. I went through it. I read it six times, so I understood every part of it. And then I called out there to make sure, okay, what do we have to do to comply, and why are we out of whack with this? And this is the reason why. Over 10,000 pounds, we got the heavier platforms and a more safe vehicle.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But and I'm just clearing my head on this, because it's, if we're concerned about the safety of the child, the restraint system provides, in my mind, in a heavier vehicle, even more safety for that child. Okay. Hence, why don't we then? I'm feeling that maybe we're the fact that we're getting federal dollars at a certain level, or the lack of getting it, has some push for this change, and that bothers me, because it's not so much the dollars as if we're that concerned about the safety, somebody, and trust me, I've investigated a lot of traffic accidents in my career. Without that restraint, I don't care how heavy or how light the vehicle is. When you hit something, you're going if you're not restrained. And so I guess I'm trying to balance this. Why are we singling out, other than the fact that we didn't get the money and we really want these federal dollars? And that's personally what I'm trying to come to grips with.
Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Carroll.
Senator. I think the biggest, what puts us in conflict with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is they require passenger restraints in these vehicles, okay? And now when we changed the law, we said, okay, now you don't need child restraints in them. And that's what put us out of whack. They can't be built without them. And now we created an exemption for them, and they said, okay, now you're in conflict with us. That's where it comes from.
I understand.
Ms. Kelleher, can you give us an estimation of the number of vehicles from your perspective that may be affected by this as far as from our schools?
Mr. Chairman and members, about 50% of the bus fleet is owned by the public schools, and 50% are on a contract basis. So I would think we would have similar figures to the survey done. But for us, you know, either we have to cut something in the classroom, we don't have levy authority for these new standards to continue to come in, and a school bus costs a district about $100,000, so it's significant money and local resources that are invested in this way, and it's the rock and roll of this law the last two or three years, where we have spent good money and moved on, and now we're going to have to go back to our voters and our communities and explain why we're coming back to get federal money that doesn't flow to the school districts but flows to the State Patrol.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is a question for you. I'm not quite sure, but can this federal money be used to offset the cost to the schools that have to purchase this? I mean, I guess it would make sense to me that there would be a way that if, in fact, we're conforming, and this conforming, we're requiring schools to go through this conformity, that we would be able to use the money to help offset for those schools that have to do this.
That's an idea that you might want to entertain
with the author of the bill. Certainly it would appear that way. It looks like currently that money is being used for law enforcement, daycare providers, and educational purposes. But Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, federal law has very specific requirements for how we can use this money. So how we are able to use this money is for purchasing child seats for needy families, for training child safety professionals and law enforcement on child restraint, educating the public on the proper use of child restraint, and then finally for supporting law enforcement for these child restraint laws. So those are the ways in which we can use the federal money, and we're limited to those four ways, and that's in federal statute.
Senator Perry, a follow-up?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, I mean it's so here we go on the federal side, as I suppose we do in the state sometimes. We're mandating a cost. We're giving money and at the same time mandating a cost, and we're stating that we can only use that if we get the money. We can only use it for a certain thing, and then we're putting the burden on those folks that have those smaller vehicles. So, in my mind, I would just soon get rid of the smaller vehicles altogether and take those two or three kids around in the great big bus instead of trying to conserve energy. I mean, it's like a catch-22 here that there wouldn't be a way that we could maybe petition the federal government or do something that we could help these schools. I mean, I could see a school. I mean, maybe they might just say, I'm not going to mess with this, and we're going to get rid of these little buses, and here comes the extra cost of moving the children around. I don't know. I just...
Maybe, Lieutenant Carroll, you can answer this question. Is a 10-passenger van really under 10,000 pounds, though?
Yes, it is.
Vehicle weight?
Yes, it will. GVWR will be under 10,000 pounds. A good rule of thumb, Mr. Chairman, if you look at a vehicle that has single wheels in the back of it, not dualies, you can pretty much figure it's going to be 10,000 pounds or under 10,000 pounds. That's where you can kind of pretty much tell there. Get the lighter platform.
So like an F-350 Ford extended van that is 8 or 10 passengers, passenger van that is over.
One of the things we have to be careful of too when we start talking about vans and type threes is they're limited to 10 passenger by statute. That's we always want to keep them. We don't want to go to that 15 passenger van, which is more unstable. They removed those from being used for child transportation in schools.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Dibble, did you have a question? Got you on my list.
No, I was going to ask the question that Senator Perry asked about the use of the dollars.
Senator Stephen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to express support for this bill. I think that it makes sense that as a mother of a young child, and booster seats are a relatively newer invention in terms of the difference between car seats, and now we have booster seats that go for kids up to the age of 8 or a certain height or weight restriction. But we've had testimony in this committee in the past about the real importance of restraining, using a booster seat to actually keep the children safe. Just using a simple seatbelt doesn't protect their vital organs if they're involved in a serious crash. That's why I'm surprised that the School Board Association seems pretty adamantly against this, because we want to get our children transported to school safely, and I think that this just helps make that happen.
Mr. Chair. And Senator Sieben, I think that they more or less expressed the frustration over going one direction and then back the other way over the last three years.
Chair, I understand that, but my point is that there's no debate whether booster seats make these smaller children safer. So we should be doing what we can as the state legislature to ensure the safety of those children, and I would hope that the School Board Association would support that as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you. Well, I'm listening, Senator Sieben, and I still have an issue that then if that's the concern, this bill should cover every school bus. Because my 8-year-old granddaughter, who's less than 4 feet, probably weighs a whole whopping 60 pounds wet, then she should be in a booster seat in the big bus that she rides. I mean, this is what's wrong with this, and this is why I'm going to have a hard time even supporting this, because it's wrong.
You can't say it's okay to use a child seat in a Ford Focus, but or you have to use one on a Ford Focus because of its size and its weight. But if I'm driving a great big Cadillac that's a huge boat, it's okay to have a child in there who's going to float around if you have an accident. So I think I'm really, and I understand, you know, I've God forbid that I had ever have to live through investigating another accident with a child. But I'm just saying what we're doing here is kind of like it's not fair. I mean, so if we're going to have something like this, then it should affect an entire fleet so that they understand that this is the way it's going to be, rather than to throw everything at one small little group. That's not having the effect on the same transportation of kids in bigger buses.
Mr. Chairman, can I get just a little clarification, Mr. Chairman, to the senator there? One of the things is this only covers is the buses that are installed, factory-installed seatbelts. The large buses are not factory-installed seatbelts. They use compartmentalization. A large 77-passenger school bus, unless they were ordered with it, does not have seatbelts and is not required to have the booster seat. This only, the reason why we got out of whack with the federal government is because we had seatbelts in these smaller buses, and then we created a law that said they were exempt from using a booster seat in these seatbelts, and the seatbelt is there. That's why.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Lieutenant, I understand fully, but nobody's addressing the fact that sitting in, my granddaughter sitting in a 77-passenger bus in aisle 13, when that bus hits something, she's going to run into that front seat or she's going to go over the seat to the front of the bus because there is no restraint. And what this is telling me is that that's all right, but it's not okay because it's a smaller vehicle, so we can conform to get this money. So we want to protect the kids in the smaller buses, but you know what, in the bigger ones, it's okay, because it's not required by federal law, and I think we're looking at this the wrong way.
And Senator Perry, we've had this discussion in this committee on numerous occasions. School buses are designed to protect children in the event of a crash without having seatbelts. They're just made to avoid injury in the event of a crash, and they are bigger. But I understand your concern, but I don't think we want to go down that road.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Chair.
And
thank you.
Ms. Berzovsky, do you have some information for us on the fines as far as state law for noncompliance and the amount of the fine?
Mr. Chair, our state law provides that fines that are collected for violation of the child passenger restraint laws are deposited in an account, and that account is used for buying restraint systems for families in need and providing education. And I don't believe that there would be any federal restriction on the state's decision as to how to allocate the fine proceeds. So if there were a desire to allocate part or all of those proceeds to alleviating the burden on school districts or school bus owners, I don't think there would be any federal prohibition or limitation.
Well, Senator Wolf, I think there might be an idea there for you. And we'll be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Maybe in the meantime, you can continue to work with the School Board Association and others to rectify that, the issue that surrounds the cost to them. We'd certainly appreciate that because, like Senator Perry, I don't want to pass that cost on in an unfunded mandate back to our school districts or our daycare providers or whoever it might be. So I think there's an opportunity there, and look forward to that. So, Ms. Keller. Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to address the question regarding the state fund that is developed through the fines of not having your child properly restrained. That we average about $60,000 a year in those fines, and they need to be used for child seats for needy families.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
And it would be absolutely prohibited by federal law to help a school district with their booster seat needs. Is that right?
Ms. Martin?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
What's that fine?
Senator Sundrum?
federal prison? I don't know. I'd be willing to take a chance.
Well, I think we do need some interpretation probably of federal law on that and probably a better understanding of what we can do with our state dollars, which we gain by finding violators of our laws. I guess I'm not exactly clear whether the federal government can encumber or tell us how we spend our federal or our state dollars here, and that we. So I guess I would like a little more information on that. Also, Senator Wolf, that probably goes on your list of tasks. Help us clarify this as we move forward. I'm almost a little hesitant to even lay this bill over, considering the amount of work that is beginning to stack up on it. So, Ms. Marty.
If I may, Mr. Chair, this is by state statute. That's not by federal statute in terms of how we spend our state resources. So that's by state statute only. And this language has been carefully vetted with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, so we won't be coming back here again with any further clarification. So I just, to the frustration that was expressed earlier by the school bus, the school, this is a done deal with this language.
Okay, yeah, but Ms. Marty, there is a cost to the school districts and that some of us are a bit uncomfortable passing on in the form of an unfunded mandate. So in our efforts to be clear about who is eligible to use our state funds that are appropriated through fines, maybe that is an avenue that we can offer some relief to our school districts and our daycare providers in their need. So we'll go ahead and lay this bill over, but I think that it's the discussion has to continue on that point. So, Ms. Keller?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cisa Keller. I am the Government Relations Committee Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association is a group of almost 300 licensed, privately owned child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. Our providers serve over 30,000 children, infant through 12 years of age, throughout Minnesota every day. I'm here to raise concerns about Senate File 1124. One of our many responsibilities is transporting school-aged children to and from school and to and from activities during school break. We transport children in vehicles defined by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as multi-functioning school activity buses. These vehicles comply with all federal motor vehicle safety standards relative to construction, vehicle crash safety integrity, occupant safety, seating crash protection, and driver visibility. Multifunctioning school activity buses are compartmentalized and have factory-installed seatbelts. These vehicles range in weight from 9,000 pounds to 14.5. The vehicles our providers use generally range from 9,600 pounds to 9,900 pounds. Senate File 1124 amends the existing child restraint legislation to eliminate the exemption for vehicles under 10,000 pounds. The Minnesota Child Care Association is concerned that this proposed legislation, while aimed at increasing safety for Minnesota's children, is going to inadvertently put a population of children in unsafe situation. Research shows that commercially manufactured booster seats should not be used with lap belts only because they can put children in dangerous situations. Again, our multifunctioning activity buses already have factory-installed seats, mostly lap belts. if Senate File 1124 were to pass, child care centers all over the state will be forced to make one of three decisions. Stop transporting school-aged children, which would create problems for working families, as they would have to find other transportation to and from school. We would have to install add-on booster seat attachments made for school buses, which would cost about $2,000 per vehicle, or completely retrofit the existing interiors with new seats built with built-in child restraint systems, which would cost over $6,000 per vehicle. I emphasize here that child care providers' number one concern is the safety of children. This is why we use these federally recommended vehicles. Our children and staff follow the same training requirements that bus safety as the children do for the yellow school buses. Our buses already meet all federal requirements for safety. Our buses do have seatbelts, and our buses are safe and should be no more required to use further child restraint systems than the large yellow school buses. We're asking that Senate File 1124 addresses the type of vehicle rather than the weight of the vehicle to ensure the Minnesota's children remain safe. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I did have some questions on what the actual cost would be to retrofit some of this equipment, and appreciate that testimony, and thank you. Any other questions? Senator Wolf, we'll hold this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you for presenting it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I did just want to make a general statement. I appreciate the hard work that the agency has gone to in trying to work with our federal partners to figure out the precise language that would work for their purposes. But, when you bring a proposal forward, to the legislative process, legislators, there's a process to go through, and we're trying, I think, in good faith to solve some real problems that are presented at the table. And so I've never seen a bill come forward presented as a done deal with final language. And, the fact is you throw legislation into the legislative process, the only done deal that there is done by the legislature and legislators vis-a-vis the governor and his signature. So I just want to say, when you introduce an idea into the legislative process, this is what happens, and we have to have this discussion and try to surface the problems and try to solve them. So I hope we're open to some more conversation, because this is an important issue that Senator Wolf brings forward, and I'd like to figure out if we can solve it.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. I think we're all on the same page as far as that goes. Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Senator Wolf. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chair, he just stepped across the hall. His assistant went to get him. He'd be right back.
Thank you.
Back in the same chair.
Senator Gerlach, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm here today to bring this bill, Senate File 1098, before you. It has to do with expanding the technical term, I guess, is operating parameters for bus shoulders. What makes it of concern to me primarily has to do with the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transitway. But it will apply to all transitways. Let me just tell you that the construction has already begun on the Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit shoulder lanes. When the construction is complete in 2012, Cedar Avenue BRT vehicles will travel on the shoulders on Cedar Avenue from Lakeville to the Mall of America, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. This project is necessary to alleviate congestion on this heavily used corridor, and it's estimated that by 2030, this line will provide the same commuter capacity as an additional 1.5 lanes of highway. Additional lanes in this corridor, they're not in the MnDOT's future plans. And even if they were to be built, the Cedar Avenue Bridge couldn't carry those additional lanes without major reconstruction. So, as you know, we've been working on a lot of different bus rapid transit lines. And we need to be able to use the shoulders. So this is expanded authority. It'll help not just the Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit, but it'll be other transit lines in Minnesota as well. For more of the technical side of things, I've got with me Dakota County Engineer Mark Krebsbach, and I should also say that this is a MnDOT agency bill
that has been doing this in consultation with and at the request of and behalf of Dakota County primarily, I believe, but it'll help, like I say, it'll help others. So I've brought Mr. Krebsbach.
Mr. Krebsbach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Mark Krebsbach. I'm the Dakota County Transportation Director and County Engineer, and I do appreciate the opportunity to express Dakota County's support for Senate File 1098. This enabling legislation provides an important tool that can be used to improve the efficiency of transit operations on bus shoulders around the Twin Cities region. It could allow buses to operate on shoulders for expanded hours of operation and potentially up to the posted speed of the adjacent roadway based on findings of engineering study and approval by the Commissioner of Transportation. This bill is consistent with recent efforts to maximize the region's transportation system with safe, cost-effective management techniques. Such flexibility to maximize the operation of the bus shoulders may not only benefit existing express bus services where condition warrants such change, but also be important to maximize operations for the region's shoulder-running bus rapid transit, as Senator Gerlach mentioned. The region's first two BRT lines, Cedar Avenue and the I-35W BRT lines, which both serve Dakota County, will be operational in 2012. As gas prices skyrocket and dollars remain limited to make major transportation investments in our highway system, these BRT lines will provide a convenient, fast, and cost-effective alternative to these congested highways. Specifically, on the portion of Cedar Avenue under Dakota County jurisdiction, the bus shoulders have been engineered to provide a 12-foot driving surface that provides for both bus and emergency vehicle use, without the need for separate additional lanes and associated right-of-way acquisition, property impacts, and construction cost. It is desired to run station-to-station bus vehicles as an all-day service utilizing these bus shoulders without the need to weave into and out of regular traffic lanes. The speed limit provisions of this legislation may allow the BRT buses to run at the posted speed of either 40 or 45 miles an hour of the adjacent lanes, rather than the current 35-mile-an-hour maximum. This will, of course, minimize travel times, and travel times are a critical factor in the eventual success of BRT as riders seek a service that is quick, efficient, as an alternative to their personal vehicles. Of course, safety is the primary concern of any transportation agency, and that is certainly the case here. This legislation is only enabling and requires engineering study by the Road Authority, in cooperation with the transit provider, and ultimately approval by the Commissioner of Transportation. This is a similar approach to how all speed limits are currently set today and ensures that important factors specific to the bus shoulders in question are considered before any changes are made. In closing, I would like to thank Commissioner Sorrell and his MnDOT staff for their efforts in working with us to prepare this legislation, and I'm asking for your support of this bill today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator DeGryff.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chair, I have a question for the use of these shoulders. One of the things you mentioned was safety is of the utmost concern. Aren't the shoulders typically reserved for use of emergency vehicles to allow ambulances and police vehicles in case of emergency? Won't this potentially impede those emergency vehicles?
Mr. Krebsbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, this legislation wouldn't change how bus shoulders are used. There's a number of miles, and maybe MnDOT could better address the number of miles around the region that currently have bus shoulders in place that are being utilized by buses in varying capacities today. This provides a little bit of expanded authority for speed limits and hours of operation, so it isn't fundamentally changing the fact that bus shoulders are being used today. There is always that potential for conflict, and in those cases, we would have to ask the buses to move out into the travel lanes. But we would not like that to be the standard method of operation. And with the width of the lanes we're talking about, we feel that the rather infrequent use by buses and the rather infrequent use by emergency vehicles would allow for compatible operation, utilizing those lanes for both purposes.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, in the real world, when there's an accident and you need to get an emergency vehicle there, traffic is stopped. And it's pretty hard to open a passageway to get a bus into the main lane of traffic. That's why I was always taught you don't go onto the shoulder ever to stop that that lane up in case of an emergency. And that's my basic concern here. If there's a bus that has a right to be in that lane already, are we not, and we're looking to possibly even increase that, are we not creating a hazard here in moving, even a greater hazard in moving emergency vehicles?
Mr. Krebslock?
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, again, safety is our top concern as well, and it's something that we feel is an important part of the further engineering study that would be required with this. But I think what I would do is hand your question over, if I could, to MnDOT, who again has extensive experience with running and operating an extensive system of bus shoulder lanes already in place around the Twin Cities region. So we are building on that expertise, and maybe they could best address this question.
Mr. Rudine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And we have had bus shoulders on trunk highways for about 20 years now, so we have a great deal of experience. We have nearly 300 miles of bus shoulders on trunk highways in the metro area. And the drivers, I think it's important to remember, are instructed on using these shoulders, and you know, they have to give priority to emergency vehicles. So we have not run into any problems on our trunk highways, and we wouldn't anticipate any problems in this application either, because the emergency vehicles will always have the highest priority for use of that shoulder. Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I could just add,
Mr. Rudy.
Senator Gerlach did a very good job of explaining the bill, but we wanted to thank him for carrying this. This is a MnDOT agency bill, and although the impetus was the Cedar Avenue busway, it would have broader application than that, potentially. And so, you know, we're excited about the possibility of opening this up to other corridors. But, again, if safety issues arise, we always will have the opportunity to go back and revisit. And if we have to come with further changes to the statute, we'd, you know, certainly be willing to do that.
You're kind, but I have notes.
Maybe just one quick question on the conducting of the study. It says that it must be conducted by the road authority. It seems to me that you know, the buses are a transit operation. That are they excluded from actually making the study, or do they come to MnDOT to do the study? How does that all fit together?
Mr. Chair, I can answer
Mr.
that. The legislation says that the road authority would do the study, but it does have to be in cooperation with the transit provider. That is included. I think it's on the very end, that language is included. So we would be working closely with the transit provider on Cedar Avenue in our case, and certainly MnDOT would in their applications work with the appropriate transit provider to undertake that study and bring those results forward to the commissioner for consideration. It would be an important part of whatever we chose to do on these initiatives.
We wouldn't want to see them left out of the loop, certainly, on that. So, well, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you.
Senator Rest is up next. And members, we're going to try to get through these bills. We just have two left. I think we can do that.
Mr. Chairman, I bring the committee Senate File 1149, and I have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment.
Passed out. Senator Rest offers the A2 amendment to the amendment while they're passing it out. Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, it deletes Section 1 of the bill, which is no longer needed, and then it makes some changes to a couple of sections of the bill to be more inclusive of the process that needs to be taken into account with regard to design bill, and then also dealing with trade secret data and the amendment supported by the department.
Senator Rest moves the Senator Lori.
Move that. Just for clarification, I see this was first referred to Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lori, it was it needs to go to Judiciary, and the motion, this is not for the omnibus policy bill. On the floor, it was the reference was corrected to bring it to Transportation first and then Judiciary and
so
second.
Okay, so this is its first hearing. Good.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Rest moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Senate File 49 is an agency initiative, and it deals with a number, a limited number, but a number of data practices issues that have arisen for MnDOT. First of all, what it does in the first first section was eliminated by the amendment. So I would direct your attention to section 2, which addresses data privacy issues with regard to design build projects that come before the Department of Transportation. There are certain there's a certain sequencing of design build proposals where information that is provided by the potential contractor is protected data, and then there are certain choice points that in that process where the data becomes public data. And the department thought that that process needed to be clarified and made sure that everyone understands the point at which data that is provided becomes public and the points at which it remains protected. So if a project is rejected, for example, in that process, some of that data will retain its private nature. When a contract is awarded, the data becomes public data. The second section deals, or actually it's section 3 in the bill, deals with the Adopt a Highway data. I'm sure many of you have seen along our state highways a sign that says this section of the highway is supported by the Wilmer Rotary Club or maybe even a family. The department had received a request for, and there are volunteers that go out to take care of cleaning up that section of the highway. And the department had received a request for identifying information of volunteers that went out and participated in that program. And although, for example, the person with whom, or the agency or the institution, the group that contracts to actually do that, and those contracts are renewed every 2 years, that there is identified information there, it was seemed to be an intrusion to give out indiscriminately information about the volunteers and their names and addresses and who they were. And so what Section 3 does is to give some protection to those volunteers so that they also are, their privacy is not invaded. Section 4 deals with a portion of the law that was passed in 2007, which allowed MnDOT to do and which is currently underway. The mileage-based user fee approach to revenues to support the trunk highway system as a potential alternative to the gas tax. What was not done at the time was to make sure that people who participated in that, who are participating and signing up right now, as a matter of fact, to participate in that that pilot study or that ongoing study, that they would not, that their, the information that identifies them would not be personal information. This is not related to the policy itself. It's just ongoing that those folks have some protection. And then Section 5 deals with the ability of MnDOT to acquire accident information that, or crash information that helps them identify when some piece of infrastructure from MnDOT has been damaged as regards from an accident. Sometimes when the when there is a tag placed on at a crash site, that information is passed on to MnDOT when it's on a highway, and done by the state patrol, and they are able to quickly access that information to know what kind of damage has been done and where there might be some personal responsibility of another party, et cetera. Sometimes what happens, however, is that it might be a local police vehicle and police officer that is present at the scene, and although there may be damage to MnDOT infrastructure, it's not always easy to discern that. And so what Section 5 allows is for MnDOT to have access to accident data so that they can ascertain whether, independently of the MnDOT, of the State Patrol data, that they can ascertain whether there's been any damage to some, you know, MnDOT infrastructure like a light pole or a guardrail or something. And have here to answer any questions about the proposal, Mr. Peter, and I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce your name.
Zuniga,
from an attorney with MnDOT, if there are any questions. And, Mr. Chairman, the motion, as was pointed out earlier, needs to be send the bill to judiciary because it does deal with data practices.
Okay. Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair and Senator Est, this doesn't change any of the requirements or any of the procedures for a person, a citizen, requesting their data as private on their motor vehicle or on their driver's license, does it?
No, it doesn't.
So, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Est moves that Senate File 1149 be recommended to pass and re-referred
as amended.
As amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Sanjohn. Senator Sanjohn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move Senate File 346 to get it on the table.
Senator Sanjohn moves Senate File 346 to to the bill. Senator Sandrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 346 is a pretty simple bill. Actually, it's a bill to extend the existence of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission from or on to June 30th of 2016. The commission, Mr. Chair and members, has been in existence for since 1963, and I think that's about 48 years. And has, I think, done a lot of good things as it's moved forward. It's primarily known as the commission which has oversight relative to the so-called Great River Road. If some of you remember traveling along the Mississippi River, the Great River Road extends literally the length of the state, and frankly, it continues on all the way down to beyond New Orleans. So it's the Great River Road in Minnesota is part of a national scenic byway in the so-called National Mississippi River Parkway Commission. The commission itself exists or consists of 15 people, various agency people. I'm not sure how much information you have on this, but transportation, natural resources, ag, the History Center, tourism. It includes five appointees from various sections of the river within Minnesota, and then two senators and two House members. As I mentioned, it's part of a national 10-state commission that meets once a year. The commission in Minnesota, by the way, meets quarterly and talks a lot about what can we do to make the Great River Road and the Mississippi River experience more enjoyable and more fulfilling to people that are so-called lured to the river in some fashion. There's something about the Mississippi River that brings people to it, and the commission's job and goals are to try to make that experience attractive. And I think more and more as the gas prices are going up, and we continue to say this over the last number of years, but vacations might be shorter in duration, and 1 or 2 day experiences in or near the Mississippi River might be something that even moreover people are drawn to from the standpoint of shorter but yet fulfilling vacation. So, Mr. Chair, I can answer questions if you have any, but I would certainly urge support of a continuation of this commission.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Sundrum moves that Senate File 346 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans.
Good. Thank you.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members, and our next meeting will be on Thursday the 28th, and we'll have the omnibus policy bill that we put together. Thank you. Committee is adjourned.